Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
We are back with the Jones boys, Toby and Tommy Lee, and they're matching wits across a fresh dinner from something that anybody in the European theater would have killed for. But we're going to see what's going to happen here. Hal, tell us about this minute.
I'm just still a little bit hung up on them being the Jones boys. It's not,
it's well, they already have a podcast for that one.
Yeah, I was going to say it's such an unlikely pairing. All right. Minute 88. In the brick-lined interrogation room of the Strategic Scientific Reserve in London, Colonel Phillips sits across from Dr. Arnim Zola, casually slicing into the steak dinner originally offered to the scientist. Phillips chews a juicy piece, his eyes fixed on Zola. I have a brilliant theory. You want to live. Zola, his glasses glinting under the harsh light, shifts uncomfortably. You're trying to intimidate me, Colonel. Phillips feigns offense, gesturing to the meal. About your dinner? Zola glances at a paper Phillips handed him, reading aloud. Given the valuable information he has provided and in exchange for his full cooperation, Dr. Zola is being remanded to Switzerland. Phillips, still eating, leans back. I sent that message to Washington this morning. Of course, it was encoded. You guys haven't broken those codes, have you? That would be awkward. Schmidtville knows this is a lie, Zola says, his voice tight. Philip shrugs, his tone matter of fact. He's going to kill you anyway, Doc. You're a liability. You know more about Schmidt than anyone. And the last guy you cost us was Captain Rogers' closest friend, so I wouldn't count on the very best of protection. It's you or Schmidt. It's just the hand you've been dealt.
This is one of my favorite tropes that actually really happened in World War II, is the idea of breaking codes that the other side already knows have been broken, mostly the Allies. And, you know, during World War II, they actually relied on this. There were things like Project Quicksilver. It's all under Operation Bodyguard. That whole fake thing of the invasion that was going to happen at Pas-de-Calais instead of Normandy, that they were feeding the Germans through double agents and fake radio transmissions and unencoded Morse code and stuff like that the Germans were picking up and just swallowing it wholesale. So it's nice that this element was dropped into the script. I know you guys love World War II sneaky business, so this is definitely one of our favorite minutes.
It's some of my favorite kind of sneaky business, to be honest. Yeah. I'm trying to recall at what point in the war, on the other side of things, did we break the Enigma? It's a German's encoding machine.
I think it was pretty early. I think it was like 42 or 43. Into 43, that. Yeah. I know it was sometime around the Italian campaign, because they were able to track stuff for I think it was in between North Africa, or maybe it might have been just at the end of North Africa in Tunisia. I think that's when they started picking up stuff that they could tell what Rommel was doing and where people were going.
So certainly, somewhere around the time that this scene is taking place, very broadly speaking, at least, that was either happening or had happened or was in the works. And that's one thing that I've never dug into. And, somewhat familiar with the Bodyguard stuff that you were talking about, but I've never really looked into was Turnabout Fair Play. Were the ones, did the Germans, when did they know that we broke the Enigma? And did they start doing the same thing?
I think they found out after Admiral Dönitz signed the papers.
I think so. Yes.
Yeah. They weren't aware of the extent. They knew about radar, but they didn't know the extent of our radar capabilities, for example. And that whole idea, it's funny, it's passed down to today. Mm-hmm. People believe that they should eat carrots because the carotene improves your vision. And that was basically misinformation that was delivered from the British counterintelligence to tell people, you know, how do the pilots find all these ships? Well, they've been force feeding them lots of carrots so that they'd have better night vision, and that just became part of our, you know, our medical knowledge.
What a brilliant thing, because it almost seems plausible just because we'd heard it, you know, we heard it as kids and we heard it our whole lives, but somebody came up with that, and instead of saying, well, what kind of other contraption could we invent and leak misinformation about to throw people off? We'll just say it's something simple. And I mean, you could argue that's one of the most effective bits of propaganda lies ever told, just because, you know, 80 years on, it's still lingering out there with just no basis in anything, really. I mean, yes, yeah. Kids who are listening, eat your vegetables, including yeah. your carrots. Just don't
carrots.
Yeah, don't think you're going to get radar yeah. eyes.
Don't
yeah.
turn orange.
Yeah, no, Bugs doesn't wear glasses, you know, so.
Well, you gents were talking, I looked up two things. One is, according to the internet, the Germans never knew that the Enigma code had been broken by the Allies. Yeah. They just never figured it out, and so that was an advantage we had for quite a while. The other thing I thought of was the myth that Churchill allowed Coventry to be destroyed to avoid them knowing that they had broken the code, that the British had broken the German code. In other words, you know, the myth is the Allies got word that Coventry was going to be destroyed. Churchill could have saved the city, but decided not to, because then the Germans would know they'd broken the code. Apparently, that is a myth. The code knew that, or the code revealed that something was going to get destroyed, but nobody knew it was Coventry. And that's it. But I'd always heard that story and just now learned that that's not how it went down.
Yeah, yeah, and Coventry is something to see if you ever get a chance, and if you're in the UK, it's an amazing sight to that the way it's been preserved. They built a new, smaller, more modern cathedral next to it, but it's quite an image from the war that's been held in place, and just very stark, seeing these medieval tombs inside that are just scorched from the bombings.
And, you know, it's interesting because I'd heard that story as well, Brian, and this is also news to me today that was a myth. And it's one of those things that the further you get from something like World War II, and the more, I suppose I'd say, objectively you can delve into it and dive into it, you expect to find some of these painful compromises that we look back and we wince and we cringe, and then we try to say, well, if he had done that, you know, it was the devil in the deep blue sea, and it's terrible. And I don't like knowing that Churchill would have sacrificed a city, but do we understand this many decades on and things? But it's rare that a situation like that sort of goes the other way, that we find out, no, you know what, after the fact, we dig into it, and it wasn't maybe as bad as we've thought over decades.
There's another one that's very common, is about Patton, and understanding that Patton was chosen as kind of the sacrificial lamb in the Scheif authority, that all the Allies moving him around. He was really responsible for selling that whole ghost army in the South, what they called Operation Fortitude South, that he was in charge of the first American army, I think was what it was called. And he was sidelined. And then Ike portrayed him as being disobedient. And even though he was planned, they had set him up to lead the invasion of Calais, that even after D-Day, to continue the subterfuge of saying that there was really, you know, that Normandy was a feint and that the Pas de Calais was the real target, and that's when the big invasion was going to happen. They kept Patton there until sometime in July. And wow. Then they released the story that because of the soldier slapping incident, that he was demoted and pushed into the Third Army as part of the feint of Normandy. So when he arrived in Normandy, it was supposed to be presented as, well, he's been demoted, and once the real invasion comes in September, they'll have another general take over his army that's just waiting to invade northern France and Norway. But it's just, you know, and it's incredible. I mean, when you think about Patton, his knowledge and stuff, and what they had to sideline him for, just to get the Germans to believe that something else was going on. It's an amazing bit of chicanery, I guess is the word.
As I recall, the George C. Scott movie portrayed that pretty well, including Patton's anger at being left out of the main action. You know, he didn't like being the bait, or not bait's the wrong word, the red herring.
Yeah. An incredible. I mean, when you think about what was at stake, and just having him sit it out, just because that, you know, that was the plan. But everything was going. I mean, the amount of effort that they put into the fake plan seems to almost rival what the real plan was. I mean, they were setting up artificial. You know, like they sent up entire brigades of soldiers in the northeast of Scotland, like up in Scotland, and they were trying to keep them guessing, like that there was going to be what they were trying to do is give the Germans the idea that there was going to be a pincer movement, one from Calais and the other one from Norway, and then they'd close like pincers onto Germany, when that wasn't the plan at all. But being able to generate radio traffic, they actually were flying bombing missions into Norway for no reason. Just to give them the idea that they were softening up, you know, the Norwegian defenses, and move panzers and things like that to the north, to get them out of the Normandy area so they would be able to respond.
It really is staggering. I mean, I think what's probably better known are things like the inflatable tanks and you know, fake buildings and some of this stuff that at the end of the day is more superficial in a way. I mean, the fact that we're actually, you know, we're spending the gas and sending the crews actually flying the bombers out there and back, as you said, Jim, to do nothing, and these massive massive troop movements, it makes the strategy behind it, and even the strategizing behind it, is staggering to this day.
Yeah, the whole idea that they were sending out crews on difficult missions that were getting shot at for a fake. They were going to have support operations in the Balkans, that supposedly to aid the Soviets, that they were going to attacking from the east, kind of like, you know, the Germans didn't know what to think, because everything that was being fed to them was pretty much a lie. All that, I mean, you must know about Operation Double Cross, where just about every German agent that was in Britain had been turned, and they're almost like just a direct pipeline of misinformation going straight back to Germany. And they were, right. You know, there were other agents vouching for them in Britain who were also double agents. So it's stunning.
You even had, and I'm going to draw a blank on the name of the operation.
Mincemeat, are you talking about?
No, I'm thinking about Ian Fleming. And being involved in having a dead body and
mincemeat. Yeah,
that was mincemeat. Okay.
Yeah.
So right.
Yeah.
Dressing good him movie up with some about fake that plans too. And stuff.
And now a Broadway play.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's on Broadway. So
why are they going to fill the theater with water? Is that what they're going to do? Pull them out there.
And then, on Friday nights, it features a real corpse or what?
Yeah, well, and they give him theater tickets right in the pocket. That's what, I mean, it's always an amazing feat if you read The Man Who Never Was. I think they go over all the stuff that they had put in his pockets. Like he had a letter from his landlord that he was a month late on rent, and where, you know, he had gone to the theater two nights before. And just to establish this whole bunch of things, like laundry tickets and stuff like that,
there's a neat movie about that. If you haven't seen it, I recommend it. Enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, yeah. I have not seen it. Yeah. Speaking of movies, not ours, but real quick, just noting as we're recording this, there's a movie that's just come out, and I think is maybe just coming home to streaming. It's Pressure with Brendan Fraser. Have either of you guys seen that?
No, I haven't. Yeah. I want to.
Yeah, it's on my list as well. So
it's about D-Day, right?
Yeah, it's about D-Day, and it's Fraser as Eisenhower. And you don't, you know, think, well, Encino Man as Ike, but Trailers look good, and it looks really interesting. And I think an intriguing idea to just say we're going to take this picture and make it about basically the 3 hours or the 3 days rather before the invasion. So
and predicting the weather, as I understand it,
right? Yeah, the weather being such a huge, huge piece of that for all concerned.
Speaking of movies, I'm sorry, Jim.
I
loved the interrogation here. I loved the tension between the Jones boys, as you say, getting these two wonderful actors in there together to butt heads. And it got me thinking of other great one-on-one scenes from movies that involve these actors. For example, I thought of The Fugitive with Tommy Lee Jones and Harrison Ford inside the dam where, you know, Harrison says, "I didn't kill my wife." And Tommy Lee Jones says, "I don't care." It's just tremendous. You know, this butting heads of giants. I was reminded of another actor in this movie, Hugo Weaving in The Matrix, when he's talking to Lawrence Fishburne, he's interrogating him, and the whole speech about, you know, human beings are a disease, a cancer of this planet, a plague, and we are the cure. That's the moment when you think, well, maybe they've got a point. maybe I'm on the side of the robots in this one, but you know, just these wonderful, where you get these two actors together butting heads and maybe chewing scenery. And I had to struggle, but I came up with one for Stanley Tucci and The Devil Wears Prada. Anne Hathaway comes into he's the art director kind of guy. And Anne Hathaway comes in whining about how horrible Meryl Streep's being to her. And Stanley Tucci just says, "We're so quit. You're not trying. Do you want me to say poor you? You think this is just a magazine? This is a shining beacon of hope." And he gives this inspiring speech about how this is we're all working together for this great thing. And it's a neat little speech that kind of opens Anne Hathaway's eyes to what she ought to be doing in her job. So I was reminded, I think this is a great interrogation scene, the twist and just how laconic Tommy Lee Jones is here. I love the way he says the word awkward, like that would be awkward. You know, and there's so much unspoken between the two. They both know what they're saying, but neither one is directly saying it. I think that's just wonderful writing.
Yeah, definitely sizing each other up. I mean, they're both trying to figure out what the counter move is. This is a chess game going on, right? Or maybe poker. They're just kind of figuring out who's going to outbluff who and get their way.
And you know, with Tommy Lee Jones in particular, he's not a screamer when, you know, in any role when he's angry and just completely doesn't completely blow his top, but he'll raise his voice. And that voice is so commanding and so authoritative, and that distinct cadence, he's extremely intimidating. So here, when he's playing it so quiet and so reserved and so restrained, he's just holding everything back. It just, it makes it all the more unnerving because, you know what he's capable of, but in this case, just playing it back.
Well, he's holding all the cards, and in this minute of the movie, we see Zola come to realize that.
Yeah,
Zola, he's checkmated.
Yeah, the other thing about this is it doesn't look cinematic. I mean, I like the fact that they're not backlit and they're, you know, there's not 3 points of lighting. We don't see fill and thing. It's just that there's a single overhead light that's lighting the entire scene. So the intimacy of the whole thing is they're both kind of leaning forward to stay in the light, and it makes the scene very personal. You know, you don't worry about the what's going on around them. The whole thing is between two guys.
Well, right. I noticed the lighting, and I agree about the overhead lighting, and yet I note that it appears to be directly over Toby Jones. So it brings a lot of attention to his enormous forehead and baldness and his disheveled hair. It's very Toby Jones is in very stark contrast, whereas when you cut over to Tommy Lee, he's cooler, he's not as stark. The difference in, you know, his lights and darks is not as severe. Tommy is cool and Zola is under the pressure.
Yeah. It's, the other thing that I keep thinking, I mean, it's terrible and this does take you out of the movie, but as Tommy Lee is chewing on different pieces of his dinner, all I keep on thinking is when we were talking with, Scott Miles back in October Sky about how every dinner scene they had, each one of them had a bucket next to spit it out for the next take. Yeah. And it's interesting how much how much Tommy Lee Jones is not pushing things around the plate. He just, I think
he's eating. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But one of my favorite types of movie anecdotes are from young actors who don't realize about, who don't know the spit bucket. So they eat like 17 hamburgers and spend the last minutes on set puking their guts out. It's but yeah, they got spit buckets there, and you're not expected to eat all that food over 57 takes.
The greatest thing in this is a meeting of equals. These two actors I can't imagine any other two people that you could drop in that could do it with this delivery. The deliveries are both, we've seen Dr. Zola being kind of sniveling is the best word to describe it. He's always cowardly, but here he's dropped that pretense. He's dropped the idea that he's a pushover, and all he does, the only things that he says is makes observations about things that that he sees, but he's not giving an inch.
Right. But you do see his fear when he's reading the message, a little bit. Like, he's maybe not fear, but he's wondering, I think, if Phillips is bluffing at that point. It's like, wait, you really sent this message and sent this about me? Yeah. And then, as you said, Jimmy, he gets his strength back and Schmidt's never going to buy this. And
yeah, push.
Yeah. He's got an arrogance we don't see him with when he's with Schmidt, and rightly right. So, because Schmidt will disintegrate him in a second, but he knows Phillips is not going to disintegrate him.
Yeah.
He can do worse.
Yeah, exactly.
He's a survivor. He has a bit of Walter White about him.
Right.
It's just he can act like who me? Not how could you pick me to do anything like this? And
perhaps it's slowly dawning on him that this is part interrogation and part job interview.
Yeah.
in a way.
He's about to get paper clipped. Yes.
Yeah. He is.
So off to Camp Lehigh. I can't say it's a short minute. There's not that much. They're all the same length, but it does pack a lot in this particular minute and moves the plot along quite well, because you're getting all the stakes laid out without having it as just solid exposition.
All the stakes.
All the stakes.
Are we getting all the stakes?
Well,
pun intended.
A K E S. We're seeing strengths and weaknesses, all the impending shoots and ladders to come, if depending on what Zola says.
It's a really good minute. These two actors are just so much fun to watch. I would watch 30 minutes of these guys going at each other.
Yeah, and the point of this whole thing, though, is if Zola cracks or doesn't crack, how will that change anything with what Captain America is planning on doing? I mean, they're taking the fight to Hydra.
Right.
And really, there's nothing Zola can offer that is, any secret to find out stuff.
Well, I disagree. I mean, locations, timing, that giant flying wing we know is coming up. I don't think Captain America knows about that yet. Zola's got a lot to offer.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, we're going to find out about that in possibly the next minute. We're going to tune in some of that.
And certainly some insight, our guys know about all these, blue Tesseract guns and things, but Zola should be able to tell them how they work, or maybe if there's weaknesses or how to replicate it, something like that.
We need to get Zola together with Stark. That's what.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Here. And I think we're going to find out there is kind of a connection, but that's in a future movie.
In a future movie. Yes.
Yeah. Indeed. many years down the line. Wow. Well, I think we've picked this one apart like so many pieces of
to the bone. Find.
Yes, as it were.
This is a prime cut. Nothing left but the
gristle. Yeah. Wow. Well, I guess we'll find out more about this from our listeners, who always love chatting about this stuff. If you would like to continue our conversations, we're available over at our Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute Listeners Base on Facebook. If you do like the show, please don't forget to subscribe. Please subscribe and also leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
can do this all day.